just after we recorded this latest bombshell, we learned that one of the original friends of the pod, Sean Brimley, had passed away from colon cancer. Sean was one of our biggest boosters. He encouraged us. He loved the show. He told everyone about us. But that really doesn't make us terribly unique in Washington. Sean encouraged and boosted and launched the careers of literally hundreds of people. We will miss him terribly, but one of the best ways to remember Sean is to be like Sean.
Welcome to Bombshell. This is Aaron Simpson.
This is Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
This is Radha Iyengar.
Back in California, finally.
Well, yeah, I'm thawing out here.
Speaking of thawing out, Lauren, what are we drinking?
We are drinking a gift from the tremendous Jim Perkins, the brown sugar bourbon of Heritage Distilling, and it is delightful.
Yeah, it doesn't even taste like alcohol.
No, it tastes like
super dangerous.
Kind of cinnamony, apple juicy kind of stuff that's just amazing. That's 60
proof.
You
guys are going to save some, right? So when I'm there in 2 weeks, no?
I wouldn't hold your breath.
Yeah. It's going pretty fast.
It seems to be fairly popular, but we'll find something else tasty for you to drink, Radha.
Okay.
That reminds us, in a couple weeks' time, we are going to have an anniversary party, and we'll have details out on our Facebook page here shortly, but stand by for a little DC festivity celebrating the one-year anniversary of this here lovely podcast.
It'll be the event of the year.
Almost certainly, mm-hmm. Yes. Today we have a lot to get through, but first, a very special guest, and I think some new questions.
Yes.
For the new year.
We are not recycling. We revised our bombshell questions. We just decided that it was time to move on from some of the old ones, from out of the old, in with the new 2018. It's a new year, guys.
So we are very pleased that Christy Abizade is here to join us. Radha, can you introduce Christy?
Yeah. So Christy was the most recently the DASD for AFPAC and served in the administration in a number of different capacities, knows a lot about our counterterrorism relationships and specifically issues with Pakistan. And we're very excited to have her on the show today.
Thanks, guys. It's really good to be here. It's fun to do this. And Aaron, I feel like even though we've never met, like we're totally friends. So
we're like one degree of AFPAC separation away. I mean, that's just all there is to it.
That's right.
Well, great. Well, who's got the new bombshell questions to kick us off here?
I have them.
Yay.
Radha, your turn.
Yay. All right. Christy, as our inaugural bombshell question, new questions of 2018, what would your choice of entrance music be?
Okay, so first of all, I'm really mad that you guys are trying out the new questions on me because, like, this was the most stressful part of agreeing to do your podcast. But the late-breaking questions that I have been, like, panicking about over the last couple of hours. So the walk-in music one is actually pretty easy because when I played college soccer, and I actually have a walk-in song.
Oh, my gosh.
Awesome. And the one that we used was Under Pressure by David Bowie. And it's still, like, so fitting. It, like, runs in my head every time some crisis emerges.
That's completely perfect.
Under Pressure.
That is perfect. I had long thought that my walk-on song should be something like These Boots Were Made for Walking, but in reality it would be something like I Feel Pretty. So I feel like Under Pressure is really nails it. What is your most quoted movie line?
Okay, so I never quote movie lines unless it's I'm kind of a big deal. So most quoted movie line or most appropriate movie line that I could think about was Princess Bride, never start a land war in Asia.
Appropriate. I like it.
More people should listen to that. I think there's a number. We could just, you know, sort of text that around town right now. That actually might not be a bad idea.
But if it's just a bloody nose, it's not really a land war.
What book does everyone else love but you can't stand?
I would say that, like, for the nerdy crowd, I have never been a fan of Clash of Civilizations. It always felt like it was just a little too pat a view of the world, and, you know, sort of undermining of a lot of the dynamics that make, you know, culture and geography and all those kinds of things, you know, individuality sort of unique in the world. So
I always thought it was trying too hard.
That's my nerdy answer. Yeah, exactly, right? It tries to force like the world into this taxonomy that doesn't actually work.
All right, what's your favorite bar in the world?
So this question sucks, but I'm gonna go with my new favorite bar, which is in my new hometown here in Austin, Texas.
There's a lot of good bars to choose from.
Right, exactly. And my new favorite is the White Horse Lounge, which is this like awesome kind of honky-tonk two-step, just like, you know, great country bar, but with all the funkiness of Austin, where everybody's got tattoos and piercings and really good bands show up. It's a lot of fun. So you guys should come out and we should all go.
Sounds pretty good.
Awesome. Twister arms.
What is the best use of a statistic or data that you've ever seen?
You picked this question, Radha.
I did. I really wanted a statistics question.
Yeah, you just couldn't walk away from the statistics.
I really couldn't.
Let the record reflect that I tried. Radha, I tried to get out, but Radha pulled me back in.
I tried to make this one positive. Like you could come up with some use that where statistics have been useful so we can all learn to let data into our heart and soul.
Wow.
Well, the only thing I studied for was the bell curve answer. So so I'm going to do
to stick
of
with
a,
that.
Right. Well, no, I'll do a lazy stretch on this. So I have entered into private industry and I just did some of my like fancy corporate training. And I will say I am kind of now enamored with this this measurement they use in the top companies that's called, it's ENPS, right? It's Employee Net Promoter Score. And basically like all the best companies use this sense of whether their employees are loyal to the company, whether they're having a good experience working at the company as like this key sign of how effective the company is externally at sort of, you know, its mission or its business. And the fact that they have as one of the key underpinnings of whether they're successful as a company at making money, whether their employees actually like working there, I think is kind of cool. So ENPS, that's my answer.
All right. Is that the end of our new questions, Radha?
It is.
Okay. So I think mostly we want to talk to Christy about some goings on in Pakistan.
Christy, We want to spend less time focusing on like the specifics of what the Trump administration is pursuing and more talk to us a little bit about like what kind of partner Pakistan has been to the United States over the last several years, particularly in Afghanistan, the counterterrorism area.
Yeah. So, I mean, working with Pakistan, you know, having sort of the Pakistan portfolio as part of your purview is, you know, one of the most frustrating things you can do, right? You know, the diplomatic way of describing the relationship is that it's nuanced and complex. The way you actually feel about it when you're working in the trenches on it is that it is incredibly frustrating. And the frustration is that you need them. You want to cooperate with them. There are really strategic interests in the region that require you to do so. But, you know, fundamentally, their strategic interests and, you know, the United States and the West just do not converge at all of the key points. You know, for all the strategically important dynamics that are at play in the region that Pakistan has leverage over, that are critical to U.S. security interests and kind of international security interests, you know, fundamentally, we can't get to a strategic relationship because we live in sort of this transactional world.
I will just say this right now because I've had a lot of the brown sugar bourbon that Jim Perkins gave us. But the first thing I thought of was that, well, instead of a long-term healthy relationship with Pakistan, we have more of a kind of a Tinder relationship day to day with Pakistan. Fair?
Interesting.
Swipe right.
Lauren, I feel like you've really rubbed off on me, because what I was thinking was, like, we have the diplomatic equivalent of a he's just not that into you relationship with
Pakistan. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you keep showing up and bringing them flowers and saying, hey, right. Do you want to go to that New Year's party? Yeah. And
there's a lot of backup dates, I feel like, going on here. You know, there's so to bring this back to the actual world of geopolitics for just a second, I guess, Christy, can you entertain the thought experiment of what if the Trump administration had actually pursued something like President Trump's initial instincts on Afghanistan, which was to dramatically disengage, that pick a timeline, pick a plan, a ramp down or whatever, but that by some point in 2018, there were many, 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 many fewer, bordering on zero, American troops in Afghanistan. Would that change this strategic dynamic that you're talking about? Or are there fundamental other pieces of this that would still drive the kind of frenemy Tinder date, you know, elements that complicate the dynamic here?
So the one dynamic that will be ever present is that they have nuclear weapons, and that there is such a tense relationship with their nuclear armed neighbor in India that it's really important that we understand what's going on in the dynamic between the two and have what influence we do over Pakistan. Now, that being said, I do think that, an Afghanistan that has a normal diplomatic presence for the United States changes the calculation dramatically about how much we actually need the Pakistanis, right, as a partner, as enabling our interests in the region. I mean, our interests, you know, fundamentally, the ones that we can actually take action on are the ones that are focused on our counterterrorism objectives in Afghanistan. We need Pakistan to get access to Afghanistan. We need Pakistan.
Right. So if we didn't need all of that, would this look different? I mean, like, if we didn't need a date for the upcoming wedding, would we still have to put up with this sort of nonsense? Or I'm, you know, continuing this metaphor a little too far here, but
I love it. Well, look, I mean, so in 2014, this thought experiment was something that we were actually wrestling with in the Obama administration, right? At that point, the president had decided that we're going to go down to zero in Afghanistan or something like a normal diplomatic presence. And hey, you know, that is going to change the nature of our relationship with Pakistan. We still needed them because the terrorism that and the militancy that exists in the Fatah is still something that could absolutely threaten the homeland again. And, you know, our success in Afghanistan, you know, at any point in time, the likelihood that it's going to include a complete, you know, end to terrorist safe havens in Afghanistan and Pakistan are very low. And so a continuing relationship with Pakistan while you're trying to manage a weaker Afghanistan with no U.S. presence there, yeah, you absolutely need them. You maybe need them less to maintain your Afghanistan strategy, but in other ways, you need them more to help be a guarantor of security in the region. And, you know, that's something that's very difficult to obtain when the Pakistanis have a view of, you know, a spectrum of proxies or a spectrum of militants, some of which serve as great proxies for them, both in their concern, their number one concern against India, but also in terms of their influence in Afghanistan. And then on the other hand, are fighting their own CT battle that could quickly unravel and get out of control. And so strategically, no matter what, that's really important. And the only arm to deal with that is our relationship with Pakistan's military.
Rounding out this kind of regional discussion, we've talked a lot about Pakistan's attitude towards India, but obviously the Trump administration has kind of leaned in on hanging out with the Indians. Both Trump and Modi seem to have gotten off to a pretty good start there. And obviously Modi is much more anti-Muslim, both in his actions prior to his rise to power and now. So I'm just wondering kind of your thoughts on regional balance in a world in which the U.S. is tilting more towards India and India is sort of much more proactively anti-Pakistani, specifically and anti-Muslim more generally. Sort of how do we think about that that regional dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all that does is play into Pakistani insecurities about India's rise, about, you know, if India is winning, Pakistan is losing. And, you know, it absolutely implicates kind of the, you know, how far they're willing to go in what they think is their existential crisis or existential threat, which is the rise of India. So, you know, President Trump noting that we're encouraging Indian investment in Afghanistan, the closeness of the U.S.-India relationship, all of that has bearing on how Pakistan feels, even without us doing anything to reduce our aid levels, right?
Right.
And so now, on top of that, we're reducing our aid levels and basically saying, okay, we're walking away from this relationship.
Maybe to put this to the group, is it our sense that this administration is continuing, I don't want to say it's a trend, but certainly has continued to lean into a closer relationship with India in a way that was maybe either not possible previously, not desired by India in particular previously, or other geostrategic dynamics didn't allow for it? Are we kind of all in agreement that that's the shift? Now you hear about the Indo-Pacific and sort of other strategic documents making reference to that. Do we feel like that the administration's kind of all in on an India relationship and Pakistan's left dangling?
I mean, interestingly, I'll let Christy finish the bulk of this, but I think a lot of that started under Secretary Carter, the Department of Defense, who was probably the key India advocate and the key India partner within the Obama administration, and did far more than probably anyone there to really lead that relationship and deepening particularly the defense partnership with them. But he was, in a lot of ways, I think, a lonely voice because people, as you say, were distracted with other priorities. But Christy would have a better perspective on that.
The U.S.-India relationship, I think, really took a turn under Carter. And I think that, you know, we often heard from the Pakistanis about just what that meant for our relationship with them. It raised a lot of concerns. So how they feel in terms of the winners and losers in the region is going to be sort of pretty dramatically on the losing side, and then push them to other allies like the Chinese, maybe the Russians. You know, the Chinese aren't a replacement for the United States in any real way, especially on the defense side, but that certainly is a concern.
And it's certainly a major player in the region. I mean, that's always the part that, you know, you have to go back to the Cold War dynamics to remember that India, while officially a non-aligned state, had a lot of military assistance from the Soviet Union. Pakistan, following the Sino-Soviet split, had more or less allied with China. And then the U.S. and picking partners, in the region, once we had resolved or normalized our relationships with China, helped improve relations with Pakistan as well. And so there's this weird, you know, historic U.S. Pakistan China axis that's really kind of that had left India out in the cold for quite some time. And that's this big shift that I think that you see is happening in South Asia. And it's going to take a while to see exactly how that plays out and how much closer China and Pakistan get in the process. So
let me just close this out really quick by saying, Aaron, I was going to go down that same route. And I would just also highlight that the closeness with India is also consistent with the Trump view that China is our primary threat and competitor.
Yeah,
in
it's
this
really
world.
Interesting.
And so, you know, this shift kind of realigns the U.S. Sort of balance of power vis-a-vis China. And we'll see how that plays out. There are widespread implications. We've talked about them in the East Asia side. This is the South Asia side of that coin.
Christy, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great discussion of our fraught, Tinder-like history with the great state of Pakistan.
Thank you guys very much for having me. It was fun talking to you. And, you know, yes, our relationship with Pakistan is fraught, and it's really painful to deal with on so many different levels. But it's a really important one to get right. And so to the extent that we can kind of find nuance again in the relationship and figure out, you know, what the real intent of the latest Trump decision is, how much of this is a reaction to a tweet as opposed to a well thought out policy course, you know, those are really important things.
Hopefully we will see you at the Bombshell Austin.
All right, guys. Well, thank you
Thanks,
very much.
Christy.
And next time, let's do drinks.
Shall we move on to keeping up foreign relations and maybe put a little current event context on our conversation with the lovely Ms. Abizaid?
Well, so we have seen a shift here in how what the U.S. is at least saying it's going to do, claiming that, you know, with the Trump administration moving to block military assistance and the president accusing Pakistan in a tweet of years of lies and deceit. So the idea here is that the State Department and the U.S. government writ large is holding back aid in an effort to induce Pakistan to, I don't know, be more aligned with us in dealing with terrorists that are in Pakistan, to stop having quote unquote safe havens.
To be clear, at this point, we're not 100% sure on exactly which assistance to Pakistan is affected. We know, I think, for sure that some $250 million in foreign military financing, that's FMF money, is going to be held up. I guess it's less clear, to me at least, whether the coalition support funds, which is like $1 billion, are going to be hung up. It doesn't sound like humanitarian assistance or other economic dollars are going to be affected, but, you know, as my friends in Boston would say, irregardless, like there's a lot of money on the line, and we are kind of calling their bluffs in some way. Although in the Obama administration did this or did similar things at various points. Congress had put some requirements on certifying Pakistani cooperation with regard to Haqqani and some other folks, basically good behavior tests that they failed. So we've been to this dance before.
And they've cut off our access before.
That's right. In fact, I think, Radha, I think you and I were in Afghanistan during during the great Khyber Pass closing of 2009 or 10 and led to, you know, ice cream shortages at every base we went to. So it was a real hardship. I'm sure there were actual implications there. I shouldn't be quite so blithe about that. But
these are the important things.
Right. I would also say that, of course, you know, because this is sort of policy by tweet, we don't totally know what is affected, but there is this big symbolic effect that has been sort of echoed back by some of the opposition side in Pakistan, getting pretty angry at the United States, calling Trump ungrateful, calling for cutoffs, but also expulsion of diplomatic personnel and closing of things like ports or airspace or whatever. So, you know, in a world in which we're still going to have, what is it, 14,000 troops in Afghanistan?
Probably too many, whatever it is, but yes.
Possibly more.
Probably want to sort out how we're going to get our stuff to them with before we, you know, fully move to the, I don't know, tough love portion of the relationship here.
And this is just one of those examples of people keep saying that we should ignore the president's tweets because they're not a serious part of policy. Well, we don't have the backstory on how well linked this was to an overall policy debate, but frankly, it doesn't really seem like it was all that much, or at least it was not a finished policy debate. So that when he tweets something and then subsequently the State Department and DOD have to explain it, like, that's an actual policy decision, guys. Sorry, I can't ignore the president's tweets at that point in time. But speaking of tweets, I think the far better tweets we've had in the national security space in the last week and a half were on North Korea.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, Carol Cohn's back in the news. It's great.
Button, who's got the button?
Who's got the bigger button? My mom actually read the Carol Cohn's like new op-ed in the New York Times talking about gendered language and national security and, you know, said, you know, I'd never thought, you know, done the feminist thing, you know, all the way through that discussion. And I thought,
it's a missile.
Right. It's definitely interesting. You know, to one of the things that is, I was, when I was thinking about this segment on North Korea, and we'll get to the diplomacy, there have actually been some pretty big diplomatic moves between North and South Korea just today, is the origins of the North Korea program. And if you think about where they are, they're with Pakistan. And so, you know, that we are going to be, you know, sort of set our hair on fire over the Haqqani network and Pakistani counterterrorism issues. But in fact, AQ Khan has caused us way more problems in terms of North Korea and Iran than most Pakistani terror groups probably ever really could. And it just still strikes me. AQ Khan is a free man today. To my knowledge, he's never been interrogated by American intelligence or law enforcement. And remains a very interesting player in the 2000s that, because of this fraught relationship with Pakistan, we kind of allowed to just call bygones.
And I believe it's still highly venerated within Pakistan.
Very much so. Very much so. So anyway, so North Korea has a bomb because Pakistan sold its centrifuges and Pakistan got some super missiles in return. But today there were negotiations at the DMZ between North and South Korea. And it looks like the North Koreans not only are sending athletes to the Olympics in South Korea next month, but a cheer squad. And I felt like I was very excited to hear about the cheer squad.
I can't wait to see the cheer squad. I also,
I think the uniforms could be amazing. Yes. Because like the ladies marching uniforms that they have for their parade days are pretty extraordinary. So I think the cheer squad's going to be top rate.
I would love to have been in the room last week when their kind of red phone rang for the first time in a couple of years between North Korea and South Korea. And the North Koreans said, hey, yeah, we're just testing the line. Like, what are you expecting with that call? We're going to invade you in a minute. What's the latest score?
New phone, who dis?
Bills game. We're just checking the line. You're like, okay. What are you planning for at that point? But as it turns out, they were calling to say that like we would actually like to chat with you guys ahead of the Olympics. This is in parallel with the South Koreans and the United States putting on hold, at least for a while, their planned military exercises that might have caused a great bit of tension during the Olympics with North Korea. But the Trump administration is not really having any of that peace and love and happiness. They're more in the what are you guys doing over there phase.
This is one of these examples where the U.S. and South Korea actually suspended those exercises, and initially there was a little bit of like, why are we just handing a win over to North Korea on this? Why would we be stopping our exercises without any improvements in behavior of North Korea? But actually creating a little bit of space and sort of calming, soothing sounds seems to have at least moved us to, you know, possibly a really awesome cheer squad and parade coming our way. So, I mean, you know,
there's some interesting
power of diplomacy.
Yeah, there's a couple different interpretations. On the one hand, administration folks are saying, look, this is proof that pressure is working. The North Koreans realize they have to come to the table. This validates the strategy. There are certainly others who responded to or, you know, noticed that the overture from the New Year's Day speech from Kim Jong-un, which kind of set this set of events in motion, sounded a lot like decoupling, which is the phrase that international relations scholars and other folks use for the idea that you would try to put a wedge between South Korea and the United States. And
so, it's a great opportunity for that if they wanted to do so.
And so if the North is trying to peel away the South and make a separate peace, a separate deal, a separate something, that this seems like an opportunity to do that. And it's because of the bellicosity of the administration that there's a window to do that. So I don't think that the evidence certainly isn't all in, and in many ways we may hope that in fact it actually never is, but there's a couple of competing interpretations of what in some ways is objectively a good thing, which is kind of a very minor thawing, a very minor reduction in immediate tensions. It looks like we'll at least get through February and the Olympics without a global thermonuclear war, so we have all of that to celebrate. But there was Tanisha Fazal had a great article in the Monkey Cage this week as well about what a conventional war would look like in the peninsula and what some of the casualty rates might look like. And for folks who follow some of the more detailed pieces of war fighting and DOD evolution over time, she talks about the ratio between killed in action and wounded in action and what it would look like to do CASAVAC in an actual contested airspace. And so it's just a very interesting, subtle set of arguments about what some of the real costs could be of war on the peninsula. So I'm sure we'll be back to this topic many times here in the coming months. We can shift. We're really covering all of our problem children today. We've done Pakistan. We've done North Korea. And so what's next? Iran.
Iran.
Who wants to talk Iranian protests? That many people, huh?
Right. Well, I mean, I can start by saying that we should humbly acknowledge that we don't know what we don't know.
That's
which is
right.
What all of the Iranian experts, the real experts, have been telling us over and over again of like, stop pretending we actually understand Iranian politics. The dynamic of these protests is definitely different than the Green Revolution back in 2009, but is still such that like, we don't necessarily know if this is a, you know, determinative, massive political revolution that is not going to stop, or if it's a momentary resurgence against the current regime, which hasn't frankly done a whole lot to rebuild the economy and combat some of the ills that they thought that getting rid of sanctions were going to do for them.
And I think they tend to agree that it's not about us. Like, it's not.
It's very much not about us, even though we would really like to make it about us.
It's probably not about the JCPOA.
How many op-eds have you seen in the last few days by former Obama and anti-Obama officials making this all about us and the JCPOA?
Which, of course, is the Iran deal. And it seems like there's some much more day-to-day, homegrown concerns that folks are focused on. But
to make it about us for, like, just a hot minute, like, actually, on Friday, it is kind of about us for a second, not the protests, but more like what we're going to, how the United States is going to react.
I will just caveat by saying this is not about us in the sense that it is not about U.S. domestic politics or the broader removing pathways of Iran to a deal. But I do think the deal, which paved the way for this removal of sanctions, set up expectations as to what kinds of economic gains might happen, and really kind of expose the regime to this sort of, what are you doing to make the economy better? You can't just blame it on sanctions anymore. And so it kind of, there's a little bit of paving the way here of economic grievances and concerns. Now, it's hard to say which way that's going to cut. And at the end of the day, those concerns were always there. And it was more the fact that the regime there hasn't done much to improve economic conditions, or at least from the perception of the population, but it's not totally unrelated to the Iran deal.
For sure. I mean, I think that the underlying structural economic questions are pretty profound, as are some of the structural shifts, both in demographics and in urbanization, in mobile internet access, which is one of the biggest differences between today and 2009. I mean, I protest dynamics, protest and repression dynamics are the things that first got me into security questions in the first place. That was what I was most interested in as an undergraduate. And the fundamental questions of, you know, which protests topple governments and when do governments severely crack down are still some of my favorite questions in international politics. And they are deeply contingent and emergent phenomenon, and we're really bad at predicting them. And so this week, it seems like the protests have kind of quieted down, but ask us again in 2 weeks and we'll see kind of where things stand, both in the short term, but also the longer term in Iran remains pretty dynamic. And I think it's something for, obviously, we're all going to keep watching. White House mayhem.
Oh, my goodness.
So as we were sitting here recording, so clearly we don't know much of anything at all, an announcement.
And we are not a breaking news program.
Not in any way, shape, or form. But just to offer a couple of comments, a CNN story came out saying that several White House staffers are considering departing and have been asked to make the decision final by the end of the month. And of interest to this
crowd. And that
crowd,
is not unusual, although 1 year is a sort of short time.
1 year
time
is kind
mark.
Of short, and not even 1 year in one of them's case. So the person that we care about in that list is H.R. McMaster, who has been kind of rumored to be being pushed out or considering leaving and so on and so forth for a while.
I would say since he got there. I mean, at some level, this is kind of a permanent story. This is an evergreen tweet, maybe.
Yeah. So this could be completely wrong. It could be completely right. Like, honestly, at this point, whatever rumors come out of the administration have as much likelihood of being true or it's not true. But as well as that, Don McGahn, who is the legal counsel within the White House. So that would be kind of a big deal if he was on his way out. As we've talked about here before, Dina Powell, who is one of the deputy national security advisors, is departing. So it'll be interesting to see who actually replaces her, Nadia Shadlow being one of the people under consideration.
It would certainly be challenging to have both the national security advisor and the deputy national security advisor leave in the same month.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be a big, this is not a administration that's been deep on talent. Although I guess we should say in this discussion that we have a lot of new appointees having been confirmed.
Right. John Rood, the new undersecretary for policy. So the Office of Policy in DOD is, I believe, completely filled out now.
Pretty fully staffed. Yeah. Owen West got confirmed at Solik. Randy Shriver got confirmed for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs.
I mean, that's a good sign for the Department of Defense. The State Department is still in kind of its sad, don't really know how it's going to be staffing process, but I believe several ambassadors were nominated and renominated, and as well as
including Katie McFarland.
Yeah. As well as some assistant secretaries. So at the very least, they're continuing that process as though we're going to continue to have a functioning government for the next you know, several months or so.
It'll be interesting if, so one of the things that we're watching on the White House mayhem side is that we had the national security strategy released in December. We're looking for the national defense strategy to come out here in a week or two, basically at this point.
They originally predicted January 19th. I'm kind of in a, who knows, we'll see how it happens, in large part because it's not actually the national defense strategy that we'll be receiving. It's the unclassified kind of excerpt summary of it. In the National Defense Authorization Act last year, they basically told the Department of Defense something that they had always sort of had the option to do, which was write a classified strategy, which is good in some ways, bad in others. But as a piece of that, DoD has decided that they're going to release an unclassified excerpt that we can all see and decide what we think about. Congress also theoretically gave them more freedom to like not have to do quite so many tasks within the strategy, which should give them more time to actually think through things rather than spend 29,000 meetings with the Army and the Navy arguing about scenarios that we're never going to actually do. But I frankly have not heard a lot of rument about this, have not heard very much about whether or not Mattis is personally involved, which was the only reason it would matter, or how much it's actually linked to the president's budget, which will come out on February 6th. So,
well, let's put a big allegedly around that. I think they're going to ask for a reprieve to release that in March instead of February.
It's not like they haven't had a freaking year to do the whole
thing.
Yeah,
but we don't have a budget for last year, so that's releasing fair. This year's budget would be a little challenging.
You had one job.
We can keep filing that permanently under What's Next. We'll have the FY18 budget because under What's Next
any day now
for about forever. So on the plus side, we have a fairly fully staffed Pentagon. The State Department is still not, you know, but it occurs to me that like it was only a year ago that Steve Bannon was on the National Security Council and Mike Flynn was the National Security Advisor. So we've covered a lot of ground in, you know, just under a year's time here. So it's never a dull moment on White House mayhem. We do have some policy pieces to discuss. Radha, I think you had one thing you wanted to flag with regard to the immigration changes under TPS.
Yeah. So I was going to say, you know, we've talked about staffing here for state and DOD. We haven't talked a ton about staffing of other national security agencies that exist around the administration. Obviously, I tend to like to talk about Department of Energy from time to time. In this case, I'm going to talk about Department of Homeland Security. So the Trump administration announced a plan to end the program that allows Salvadorans to stay in the United States who came about a decade ago after some earthquakes. El Salvador, while having rebuilt many of the problems from the earthquakes, has a number of violence and conflict-related issues going on. And so
the program actually covers more than just Salvador, right? I mean, Haitians have actually been affected by these decisions, which came out last year, other folks in Central America. But El Salvador was this week's decision, right?
Correct. And in particular, the El Salvador decision and why it's relevant for other countries is that the reasoning behind the decision, in as much as we think there's going to be consistent reasoning going forward, is that, you know, this initial reason that allowed the Salvadorans to come in was related to these earthquakes. And even though there continues to be violence and instability, and it might be extremely unsafe for these people who've been here for over a decade to return to Salvador, that initial cause was over and they should return home. As Aaron mentioned, this also happened for Haitians and Nicaraguans who lost their support last year. So this is kind of an ongoing low burn program, which is sending home a number of immigrants back under this initial under the idea that this initial designation was intended to be temporary. The issue here is that as we look sort of forward to individuals entering the U.S. from countries affected by armed conflict or natural disaster, these aren't necessarily refugees, but these are individuals coming in under a variety of different immigration programs, we start to wonder sort of what's going to happen with the rest of South and Central America in the current state, and in particular with Venezuela.
Yeah, The Daily from the New York Times, the morning podcast, had a good segment today. We're recording on Tuesday, on the emergence of MS-13, first in the U.S., and then how our deportation policies basically exported that back to Salvador in the 1990s, and how that has sort of played into this dynamic of political violence, social violence in Salvador, and the kind of ongoing crisis there. So they had some good background on just how long kind of this kind of interweaving of the immigration policies and the security policies of the U.S. Salvador, of course, had a civil war in the 1980s, and we backed the government against what we perceived to be communist rebels. The Soviet Union spent a lot of money aiding communist rebels in Central America at the time. So there's a lot of Cold War dynamics that have really interesting kind of echoes and legacies, you know, now 30 some years later. So it'll be, I think you're right. We went from a fairly permissive condition under the Obama administration to a much more restricted disposition now today under the Trump administration. And it'll be interesting to see just in terms of policy, how that gets fully codified. Have we any other mayhem to discuss?
Not yet.
There'll be, it's never a dull moment on this front. And of course, we refer you to our friends at the Lawfare podcast and Rational Security and others for a full dissection of the kind of the Mueller investigation and the other elements therein. We are not lawyers, and we'll let those who pretend to be do better jobs explaining all of those details. So
I will say the Rational Security folks had a good tip for us, which was to take up real day drinking, i.e. drinking in the morning, not just our apparently lame version of day drinking, which is drinking in the afternoon. So I feel like they have all sorts of tips and background that folks could try to adopt at their own peril.
That's very interesting. For as much as I like to drink, I almost never drink in the morning.
Well, on the weekend.
No, I'm not even I'm not a hair of the dog or a brunch drinker, really, either.
Oh,
so.
I'm a brunch drinker. Brunch drinks are delicious.
They are delicious. Agreed.
I mean, but like, I don't want your nasty orange juice in my champagne. Like, just give me a glass of champagne.
Oh, yeah. That's what my family does.
Yes.
I mean,
okay. Well, you're the shower champagne queen, as we remember from a year ago. So, I mean, that's the way to go, obviously. Okay, ladies, what is next? Lauren, you mentioned we have some Iran contretemps to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, this Friday, we get to see if the president decides to certify the Iran deal again. It will be interesting to watch because they obviously he has been closely following, as much as he does, the protests in Iran. He may have sort of persuaded himself that he can't possibly continue to waive sanctions for the Iranian regime while also supporting the protesters there. A lot of folks think that's actually the best possible idea, so that you can have some measure of pressure against the regime with regard to other kinds of sanctions, which we are well within our rights to do on human rights issues or on counterterrorism issues. But, I mean, frankly, he's never been exactly a solid, sane citizen on the Iran issue. So we'll see where he goes.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the question of sort of snapback on the sanctions that seems to be fully having walked away from in the October decision. The real question now is like if we're going to push harder on the sanctions question next. Radha, what are you watching?
Well, this isn't really what I'm watching, but I will say that I have been enjoying learning more about Anna Mae Hayes, the first U.S. military female general, who just died at the ripe old age of 97. She was an
Amazing.
Army nurse and the first U.S. First woman in the U.S. Armed Forces to wear the insignia of Brigadier General. So NPR and Task and Purpose had really excellent articles on her. And as we're sort of looking forward at a variety of different changes happening in Department of Defense composition, it's a great story and worth folks reading and remembering.
I'm, of course, watching the budget, which we don't have yet.
Shocker. Mm-hmm.
So we'll just keep an eye on that. Okay. We wanted to save.
It's still going to be what's next.
Well, yeah, for it's like permanently in that category. We wanted to save a little bit of time in pop culture. I know what Lauren wants to get to, but I want to return to a topic we discussed before our holiday hiatus, which was The Crown. And Partially because I may or may not have gone back and rewatched a significant amount of The Crown for a second time through over the holiday break. But also because, one, my favorite fashion blog, Tom and Lorenzo, has gone through and done their Crown style, where they analyze the episodes through the fashion and costume design of each episode. They've done this for Mad Men, they've done this for Outlander, now they've done it for The Crown. It's like my favorite thing. So if you are into any of these elements, it's very interesting to go through and look at what the Queen actually wore, what Jackie Kennedy actually wore, the blues, the greens, the browns, all of these sorts of things. But the episode that I just wanted to come back to just for a second, because I would love to know whether the creators meant this to be courant in some other way, but the episode on Edward VIII being just a total freaking Nazi is really compelling. It's fairly emotional. It's really about these questions. The Queen is struggling with these questions of kind of forgiveness, and should she let her uncle, who she's actually quite fond of and has been actually fairly good to her, despite having been a total cad to the country, basically, back into the country and to have a public role. And she's confronted with Edward VIII's, her Uncle David's role in World War II, and just how clearly aligned he was with Hitler's Germany and his deep fascist sympathies, including those of his wife, Wallis Simpson. No relation, let the record reflect. And so it's much more political than a lot of the episodes, which kind of have focused on particular dynamics between Elizabeth and Philip. But it speaks to a current set of discussions and debates in many ways as well. And so it just has sparked a lot of discussion in my small, weird little world. So, Lauren, you had a different pop culture topic.
Okay. I have been putting a lot of thought into the new Star Wars movie. And in particular, it is really, really bothering me. Hyperspace missile possibilities, hyperspace drones. Why haven't we seen these before? It's kept me up. I don't know how many nights I have debated with my husband multiple times. Like, what are the possibilities of why we haven't seen this before? Was it like just so insanely off limits that you would never think of at a hyperspace speed ramming another ship? Is it that it's actually just way too expensive to do so? Is it that drones are impossible to create that would be able to actually physically ram a ship because you have all these other kind of triggers that would prevent it from breaking at a hyperspeed to hit a ship? Clearly, I'm really obsessed with this. And I need to hear from other people about who are also obsessed with this. And maybe we can all go have a drink together and sort of like huddle and be weird.
I think several drinks would be appropriate for this conversation.
Yeah.
Radha, have you even seen it yet?
No, but we do have plans to see it. And in fairness, it's like literally killing my husband that he hasn't seen it yet. So we got to get this one under our belt. I was totally willing to just read the summary of it online, but
like any sane person would be.
I would say, to the surprise of no one, my very good friend Michael Horowitz has a number of organizational explanations for why it had not occurred to previous imperial bureaucracies about why this hadn't happened before, because not all new technology gets adopted and used in the same way by all people. So we can stipulate that perhaps you and all of our fellow nerds.
They needed a better process?
Perhaps.
Maybe.
Certainly a better innovation process.
There's certainly not like any kind of innovation office within the
Imperials. I have a lot of questions about civil military relations, just in the Empire, but now
in
the Resistance.
What the hell is going on
there? There are no civilian leaders as far as I can tell. Also, Poe deserves a general court martial, which kind of breaks my heart. It would be the like most attractive court martial in a very long time.
Yes.
But we digress.
What are the differences between generals and admirals in this universe?
Right. What is even that about?
Right.
And how do we make that distinction? Anywho, we have questions.
Radha, do you have pop culture concerns this week?
I have none.
Okay. You've just been parenting
my life.
In a blizzard, and you're just happy to be home in California.
That's right. I'm like, you know, I have to say the 9-degree weather did not do a lot to make me feel like the northeastern winters are really winning it.
I got cute new booties, which I felt very justified in buying. So that was a A+ win for me in the first week of January.
I ordered sparkly Rothy's, which were here waiting for me to wear socks.
Of course,
while
you did.
I walk around warm California.
Perfect.
So that's what's going on.
Perfect. We're all living our very best lives.
That's right.
All right. Well, we will join you all with details of our anniversary party and perhaps a very special anniversary episode here in a couple of weeks. We'll see you then. Thanks.